Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days.
I mean, I feel like the waterfall of thoughts. And every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala New York podcast.
Yes, welcome to episode 102 of the podcast. I am Dave, your host. I am sitting in my apartment. It is hot. It is very hot. It is very humid. It is unpleasant. I'm not ashamed to say that the world is unpleasant right now. And I'm also not ashamed to admit that I have air conditioning. And I'm using it. And I'm enjoying it. If I were just sitting and being hot and feeling unpleasant, I would be angry or depressed. And I don't want to infect you with my problems, so therefore I have air conditioning. How's that for justification? Hey, today on the podcast, speaking of anger, depression, moodiness, and all sorts of mental expression, today on the podcast, psychotherapist Natalie Baker, a regular contributor to the podcast, a teacher in the Shambhala Buddhist tradition, she's going to talk about meditation, fixing the brain. What does that mean? Where is the latest research? How effective is meditation with mental health? What is the science telling us? This is a great talk, actually. I'm glad you're listening. And you're really going to want to pay attention to Natalie Baker. But before we get to that, I do want to mention that the Shambhala Meditation Center of New York is presenting a week-long meditation retreat. It is the week of Friday, August 19th. It's August, but I'm told there will be air conditioning. But more importantly, there will be an opportunity to practice meditation for a week. Or if you can't do a whole week, you can register by the day. But it's really a great opportunity to deepen your meditation practice. It might feel overwhelming, but I promise you it's not. Having done these types of retreats, you can do it. There's great support, there's great teachers, there's great staff around these things helping you, and it is, frankly, a very profound experience. So for more information and to register, click the link on the homepage, ny.shambhala.org. This is Urban Retreat, 7 days of mindfulness meditation, the week of August 19th. And now, here is Natalie Baker.
You'll have to excuse me, I'm at the very tail end of a cold that's left me a little bit hoarse, so I have my hot water, and hopefully that will see me through our conversation. I chose a rather large topic for tonight, and I'm really just going to skim the surface and hopefully engage your curiosity in this very interesting trend that's taking place, where meditation and mindfulness is leaving the realm of spirituality and entering the realm of science and mental health. And what does that exactly mean, and what does that do for us? And what was the intended purpose of meditation practice from the, in this case, the Shambhala Buddhist lineage? You know, in medicine, they talk about using drugs off-label. So now there's this trend where they use this antipsychotic medication as a sleeping aid. That'll be interesting to see what happens with that. But there's definitely a trend in our culture where we appropriate things and use them to our ends. So I thought we could talk first about when we talk about or when we use meditation practice to help ourselves with our mental health, what are some of the assumptions that we may consciously or unconsciously be bringing to that activity? And then I want to talk about what the point of meditation is in this spiritual tradition, so that we have a little bit more information, particularly if we're new, about its intended use, dosage, duration, and for how many years we're going to be on this drug. Your lifetime is the answer, and maybe the next few. So the brain, that's the new frontier, right? We're all in the area of mental health. We're all very interested in the brain and what happens in the brain. And I think it's interesting that most people, when they locate themselves, like if I ask the question, where in your body would you locate yourself? Where do you say? Just sort of first thought. Right? Up here, usually. Some people say in their heart center, but most people say up here. So that's a very interesting assumption. And certainly in the area of mental health, which, you know, we could say that's about the exploration of how do we ease our suffering, particularly our suffering of the mind or our mental suffering. And we've discovered that the self is actually located in every cell of the body. So when I first started training to be a psychotherapist, like 20 plus years ago, a lot of the interventions were mind interventions, talking about biochemistry and developing insights, right? Even though Freud said many, many years ago, insights are not curative. Nevertheless, that's what we kind of were looking for. And then some emotional expression. But often the focus was neck up. And what we've come to understand, particularly in the field of working through trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder, we've come to understand that actually the most success comes when you work with the body as a whole. That the body and each cell, and actually in cell biology, the more sort of cutting-edge cell biologists have discovered this, which is that memory is held in every cell. Not in particular cells, but actually in every cell. And that each cell's organization is mirrored in our entire organism. So the assumption that we have that we are located in our heads is actually an inaccurate one. We're actually located in every cell of our bodies. So that would be a very interesting practice to do, to remember when we think about me and we usually like kind of get up here, to go, oh, I'm actually in every cell of my body. And we could like be aware of our entire bodies as we talk about ourselves, as we experience ourselves. That would be a little bit more accurate. We also, in sort of fixating on the neck up, we thought, you know, the big success is going to be in the development of psychopharmaceuticals back in the late 80s. And we discovered that neurotransmitters have a big role in mood, and that people with depression they weren't producing or weren't processing enough serotonin. And so it was like, wow, it'd be so cool. We'll just give people more serotonin or allow the serotonin to have a longer shelf life in the system, and then that will solve the problem. Well, a friend of mine who's a psychiatrist and also a psychopharmacologist told me that in drug therapy, they have about a 35% success rate. So that intervention turned out to not actually be the entire picture. And interestingly, so I brought a little show and tell tonight because if you're really interested in these topics, it's good to read. So this is a really fabulous book. If you're interested in trauma, I see some heads going, yeah. It's The Body Keeps the Score. Dr. Vanderkolk, who is one of the leading clinicians, which is very exciting. He's a real practitioner of psychotherapy and spent a long time researching trauma. And he was at Boston Hospital when psychopharmaceuticals really came out in the late 80s, and they were so excited. And he talks about the disappointment that they all experienced when medication didn't do what they hoped it would. And he cites one interesting experience he had where in his trauma center, they did a study of giving Prozac to people suffering with PTSD and found that the people at the trauma center, which was sort of mixed, a lot of it early childhood trauma, abuse in childhood, that they responded well to the Prozac. But they also then did a group of Vietnam War vets, and that had no impact on that population. And he mentions in that book that he still does not understand why that medication had a positive impact in one trauma group and no impact in another. So part of the story here, newscast, is, you know, we don't understand a lot at this point, really, the onset of imaging technologies in the 80s was another kind of boost in understanding, where we have MRI machines now where we can see what's happening in people's brains who have different sets of symptoms, different conditions. But, you know, we just discovered, 2014, I think, the news came out that they found that there's a very, very subtle lymphatic system in the brain. And the job of that lymphatic system at night when we're asleep is it actually flushes the toxins from the breakdown, metabolic breakdown that we have during the day. So just a couple years ago, there was a major breakthrough in what the point of sleep is. Right? Like 2 years ago. So, you know, we can feel good about the fact that there's a lot of good intention and people are working really hard to, from a Western medical, Western science point of view, to understand, you know, what is going to make us less anxious, lift our spirits, right? Work through our traumas. What's going to help us be more content in our lives. But the reality is we actually understand just like a teeny tiny bit of how we work as a system as a whole. And really, you know, when we... So about 5 years ago, I'll go this route. About 5 years ago, one of my meditation students came to me and said, "Have you heard of neurofeedback?" And I was like, "What's that?" And he said, "Well, it's apparently this new technology, EEG technology that reads your brain patterning, and it gives the brain feedback and allows it to shift out of depression and anxiety and the fight, flight, freeze response. And I thought, wow, that's amazing if that actually works, because as psychotherapists, one of the things we're trying to do is to get the brain to stop doing those things, those maladaptive patterns that really are not serving. So if there was a new technology that was going to help with that, I thought, that's very cool. But one of the other assumptions that we have, so I got curious about this technology, tried it out, saw it had an impact, so I brought it into my practice. But I learned a couple of very helpful things. One of which is that one of the assumptions we have as Westerners is we think in a linear way. We think positive results will occur slowly and gradually, like that graph that goes up really nicely, right? So maybe like your hours of meditation here on the x-axis, and then your sense of well-being rises along the y-axis, and it looks so pretty, right? We all like to think like that because that's knowable and controllable, and we love control, especially when we're anxious. But actually, the brain is not a linear system at all. So what is a non-linear system that we can use as a counterpoint here? Well, the weather is a non-linear system. Right? We know that in spring, sometimes we get a dump of snow. Or all of a sudden, in May, it's like 92 degrees. Right? That's a non-linear system. It's not predictable. And that's actually how the brain operates, the body in its entirety operates. It operates as a non-linear system. Now, of course, there is some linear aspects, right? We're all aging. That is happening for certain, right? But we don't know when we're going to get sick. We don't know when we're going to die. That's a non-linear system. So when people come in, when people think about wanting to be less anxious, wanting to be less depressed, wanting to eat, sleep better, the underlying assumption that we have is that we're going to know that we're making progress because the change looks like that pretty graph, right, of that nice, slow, but steady increase. Whatever it is, hours of sleep, you know, days of feeling like we can get out of bed and accomplish our task, right? Feeling calmer. And if things don't look like that, right, it triggers our fears and our doubts. Is this working? Am I working? Right? So when I introduced neurofeedback into my practice and watched people, so how neurofeedback works is it's taking the EEG sensor information off your head. So your head your brain communicates through chemicals and through electricity. So it's using the electrical communication of the brain. And one of the things I forgot to talk about this. So when I was in grad school, speaking of like how much we don't know, when I was in grad school, I learned this in undergrad, so this is like 25 years ago. I was taught in neuropsych that the brain is a fixed system. So if you had damage in a certain area of the brain, like the language center, and you had a stroke, well, I'm sorry, but you would just lose that functioning. It's gone. Nothing you can do. It's the equivalent of being taught that the world is flat. This wasn't that many years ago. Right? And now we all, everybody's like, yeah, but the brain is plastic, right? We all know that, you know, neurons that fire together wire together. Right? So now we all are kind of catching on that the brain is actually plastic, that it can rewire itself, but it needs good information to do that. So the point of neurofeedback is it's giving the brain a mirror to its own electrical patterning, which it can then self-correct. But it doesn't self-correct in a linear way. So that was one interesting thing that I learned, is that people would have, you know, a relief of their symptoms, and then all of a sudden a flare-up of their anxiety was back. And then it would taper off again. And you watch people's expectations and their fear, right, go in conjunction with witnessing the non-linear nature of change in our beings, in our biology. But I also learned something else that's very important, which is that you can't change the brain without also looking at your mind and looking at your beliefs, which is very interesting, because where exactly do those thoughts live? Scientists can't tell you where your thoughts, where your beliefs live in your brain. Like, if you're not thinking about your grandmother, is her memory still alive in your brain? Right? So there's a very immaterial aspect. And I came to understand this very vividly when I witnessed people who would come for neurofeedback training, and the people who would come and say to me, I am sick and tired of my anxiety. I don't need it. I don't like it. It's not who I am. Or whatever, you know, their depression. That those people would change very quickly from their brains getting the feedback about its maladaptive anxious patterning or depressive patterning, and their symptoms would shift. And then there were the people who had real ambivalence. Well, isn't my anxiety part of how I get the job done? Isn't my anxiety what makes sure that I accomplish what I need to accomplish, or that I stay aware of the things in my environment that aren't safe? And interestingly, those people who had a strong belief that their anxiety served a purpose for them, they didn't shift so quickly from the neurofeedback. So that was very interesting to observe, that mind and brain have to be in unison with each other in order for those changes to happen. So now I use my hand as the analogy, right? You can't really, let's say you have a broken hand, right? You can't just care for this half, this side, the palm side of your hand, right? You have to include the back side, right? The brain, the physical structure, the mind, right? wherever our minds actually are, right? Every cell of our body. That they have to actually work together. We have to look at our beliefs in order to really affect change. Where should we go? Okay. So you may have the message by now that we have some assumptions bringing mindfulness awareness practices, meditation practices into our Western, secular, material, linear point of view. There's a few holes that it's good to just be aware of. It's good to be aware of the fact that the healing human mental suffering from a Western medical psychotherapy point of view is in its infancy. Like maybe, arguably, 100 years, we could say. And there's so much we don't understand at this point. But that's okay, right? There's lots of motivation. That's the cool thing. Lots of people want to heal and help others and figure this out. So then we're like, wow, let's go look at that Tibetan Buddhist meditation thing and see what's happening there. So the good news is that the research is showing that meditation does have a positive impact on the brain. In case anybody didn't get that broadcast. So we have research that shows it's easier to concentrate, So in 1994, we discovered these really cool things called mirror neurons, which are the specialized neurons that allow us to empathize. So those centers are highlighted when people practice compassion practices. So that's good. The amygdala, which controls, right, whether or not we send out that, like, I'm freaked out, the world is not a safe place, right? That calms down, that functioning when we practice mindfulness, awareness, meditation. So it definitely, it's worth the effort to do it. But I think it's also really important at this point to now switch to, well, what was its intended use? Right? As a spiritual practice, what's it supposed to accomplish for us? Why do we sit here? Well, the answer is pretty radical. As a mental health professional, their claims are pretty outrageous. And of course, the claim is the complete eradication of all suffering permanently. I think we should put that at the bottom of the Shambhala Center website, right? But Trungpa Rinpoche, who started the Shambhala Centers, I remember someone once telling me a story of him pounding his fist and saying, but there's no money back guarantee. So the complete annihilation of suffering permanently. That's the point of the spiritual path, the Buddhist, Shambhala Buddhist spiritual path. And the main technique is meditation, mindfulness awareness meditation, in its many different forms. And the frequency is every day. And the time span is lifetimes. Now, you may or may not want to get into the whole topic of rebirth and reincarnation, but just to like sit with that for a minute, because I will tell you one of the biggest ways people suffer that I observe in my psychotherapy practice is having a very unrealistic expectation of the rate of change. And then that just creates a self-attack and self-doubt and more fear and more anxiety and more depression. And everybody, it doesn't matter, everybody has their different sense of like when things should be done by. I should be over X by Y, varies for everybody. But for everybody, like, they're not far enough along. So I think it's helpful, just kind of given how we like to torture ourselves, to just note that in this tradition, the conversation is in terms of lifetimes. That's the rate of change. That's fine. It's actually like not a problem. Not a problem that it takes many lifetimes of meditation practice, which is really curious, right? Because we're like, everything should have happened yesterday. So the complete and total eradication of all suffering through the practices of mindfulness and awareness meditation every day until it happens, which may be lifetimes, maybe this lifetime, right? Hard to say. Another thing we should know about mindfulness awareness meditation in this context is that this research has been taking place for 2,600 years, nonstop, for 2,600 years versus 100 years. So that's just good to know, right? They've been doing this a long time. And it's a living tradition. And what that means is that it's passed down teacher to student in the conversation. So meditation instruction happens live, right? So you go in the other room and you receive meditation instruction. And then you get to ask questions. And it could be one of us. It could be somebody who sits on a throne, right? But the point being that it's a living tradition, and that people who are maybe a little bit further along the path, but, you know, who knows? Some of you may be much further along the path than I am and have much to say about the nature of mind. But the idea being that we help bring each other along. And that when you get to certain stages of your mindfulness awareness practice, there is a very important meditation instruction that happens between the teacher and the student, where they actually, in a very vivid way, help you see the nature of reality as it actually is, as opposed to how we see it in our confused minds. So some of the meditation instructions are very powerful and very, very helpful. And those then become the reference points that you use to stay with your meditation practice. It's also a wisdom tradition. And what that means is that the teachers, particularly who are teaching at the more sort of more advanced levels of practice, where we're getting much more into the subtleties, that those teachers are teaching from their experience. It's not theoretical. It's their lived understanding that then gets communicated to the student, so the student also has a lived understanding. And another way to say that lived understanding is to talk about it in terms of non-conceptual awareness, non-conceptual experience. And the way that we are becoming familiar with that principle as new students is by placing our attention on the breath, on the sensations that we experience as the breath moves in our body, in and out. And when we notice that we're lost in thought, right, we make a note of that as different, and we label that thinking. And then we place our attention on the experience, the sensory experience of breathing, which is non-conceptual. And then poof, right, we're back in our heads. And we're like, am I meditating? Is this really working, right? And then we go, oh, whoa, I'm not meditating, I'm thinking, right? But actually that moment of recognition is meditation. So please don't be discouraged that you get lost in thought all the time, because really the practice that we're doing is we're practicing that dream that we fall into of just being lost in thought without actually being awake. So we wake up at some point, right? And we go, oh, wow, I was just lost in thought. And then we give ourselves the instruction again, and we go back to the sensation of the breath. And when we're new to practice, and by new, I mean like it could be a few years, right? We're sort of tussling with this koan of what is immediate experience? What is my experience without that commentator always commenting? Is that okay? Am I going to become a vegetable? That's always a fear. I'm just going to turn into a blob if I don't constantly engage in mental chatter. So it's a wisdom lineage. It's non-conceptual understanding of the nature of mind and the nature of reality. And it's through our own immediate experience that we progress along the path. But then there's also another part and then we'll have a Q&A, which is that we have to look at our beliefs and we have to be willing to cultivate a different set of conceptual reference points in order for this to really work. Maybe like I said about neurofeedback, in order for it to work more quickly, to see the results sooner. Because if we're sitting in meditation practice, which is basically doing nothing, right? I mean, you're not really doing anything. And you have a belief that I'm a piece of shit. How is that going to work? How is that a good idea to sit there and watch your breath if you're just a no good, bad person? At some point, you're going to get up and start doing stuff, right? Because in our culture, that's what makes us feel good about ourselves, right? Is we're productive, right? We get out there, we do things, and at the end of a hard day's work, then we're allowed to do this and go, you know, maybe you're okay. Maybe you're a half decent person. You know, you worked really hard today. So if we have that conceptual framework and we bring meditation practice in, and change is non-linear, we're not really going to stick with the meditation practice. So very interestingly, when Trungpa Rinpoche, so he founded the Shambhala centers in the 70s, came from Tibet. His eldest son, Sakyong Mipham Rinpoche, is now head of the Shambhala centers, just to give you a little background here. So when Trungpa Rinpoche came to the West, the teachings that he presented, the main teachings that he presented, were the Shambhala Dharma, the Shambhala teachings. And he made it very clear that these teachings were for this place and time. So this place being the West and this time being, you know, we're householders, right? We're not monks and nuns, we're not meditating all day in caves and asking for handouts to survive, right? We're out in the world, having families, having jobs. So that's also another, I think, helpful thing to think about, is that the Shambhala teachings, which are our wisdom teachings, were specifically for this time and place, for Westerners with our busy lives. And the primary teaching of the Shambhala Dharma, which is a mind, it's a like a wisdom teaching, is the notion of basic goodness, that our fundamental nature is wholesome. So when Trungpa Rinpoche was talking to mental health professionals, he referred to basic healthiness. So the other part that's important to note, if we're going to bring meditation practice into our lives as a tool, it's also helpful to bring in ideas. We don't have to buy them wholesale, right? We can think about them, we can contemplate them, but that we need the supports of a different reference point for our minds. And so the first reference point that we were given in the Shambhala teachings is the reference point of fundamental sanity or fundamental goodness. And the reason why we can sit in meditation practice and do nothing is because we are at our core, in our nature, wholesome, good, sane. And then the next two principles, and then hopefully if you can, take level one of Shambhala training with Ethan in July. It's a really nice way to deepen your meditation practice and hear some of these teachings. But the next two ideas that he introduced through the Shambhala teachings were about how to work with fear and fearlessness, and gentleness. Oh, I wonder why gentleness, right? Self-aggression is probably our biggest preoccupation. So I think as Westerners, we do need the scientific proof that meditation has a positive impact, right, on our brains, on our sense of well-being, and to remember that the tradition that it comes out of is a vast and a profound tradition. that has a lot of depth if you're interested in exploring it. It's kind of like, this is a New York City analogy, it's kind of like using a telescope to spy on your neighbor across the street, right? It's, you can do that, you can check out what's going on, but really, you can see the stars with it. That's its intended purpose. So on that note, we can have a discussion, and really anything that you want to talk about, anything you'd like to share or ask.
I'm so glad I'm here. This is kind of the perfect talk for me to hear because I'm just beginning my path, and I'm also considering going back to school to be a psychotherapist. And recently, I actually went to a hypnotherapy session for anxiety, and I didn't know what to expect, and I was actually quite struck by how much the session felt like a guided meditation to me. And it started to make me think about whether there is a kind of shared language between Buddhism and psychotherapy. And I was wondering if you could maybe talk about how maybe one informs the other for you as a practitioner or just as a person.
Maybe you can say a little bit more about the more specifics of the shared language. Like, what is there an area in particular that you're curious about, or?
Not really. It's sort of more of a general question. I'm just starting to think about any kind of commonality between the two, how maybe Buddhism can be incorporated into sort of a more compassionate or holistic form of therapy.
I think the most helpful thing, just speaking practically from my own experience, as a psychotherapist, to have confidence in people's basic workability is a huge relief. Because people have so much self-doubt and confusion and pain, and it's very easy to get seduced by it and think, oh my God, it's never ending. But actually, so now to bring in the practice of meditation and how that's a support is that there's always gaps. Nothing's actually solid. So even in our stories of pain and confusion, doubt, there's actually gaps where things actually are okay. So to be able to call on the present moment as a support is a really where it all happens, in the present moment. So when we practice meditation and we're constantly inviting ourselves back over and over and over again, slowly over the years, and I mean years, we start to really get it that the only thing that's happening is the present moment. That's it. And so that becomes a huge support. Narratives are just like clouds. They don't really exist.
Thank you so much, Natalie. There's so much in your talk that I have questions about, but I want to go back to something that you first said about memory and how it lives in the body and in each cell. Because I'm coming out of a kind of a period of intense stress of my mind and body, and noticing that while my mind, while the stress has cleared and the mind is starting to clear, that there are things in my body, that aches in my body that just weren't there before, that aren't in my mind they're not, I can't say that they're because of I stressed myself or I hurt myself. I just feel pains that almost seem psychological, like almost like there's a raptor with its claws in my shoulders. So I have two questions. One is, if memory is cellular and our cells are constantly changing, how is that passed on? And two, how can we work with that kind of cellular memory to eradicate pain as well as suffering?
Yeah, that's a good word, right? Eradicate. Let's eradicate that pain. Well, that's very interesting. I mean, how does one cell pass on the information to the next generation of cells, right? And we can see, so you're asking about karma. That's the topic, right? Is how do we energetically pass on information? And it's very interesting that does happen, right? I mean, we can definitely be still feeling the pain of what our grandparents went through in whatever they went through, right? In the Second World War, or, you know, those are real, and we all have stories in our families of those pains getting passed down from generation. And it's interesting because, you know, another thing that happens when you meditate is that if you do have things that you're keeping in a box, so there's a very cool thing that children do when they're in traumatic environments is that they find coping strategies. And they're very effective, right? They have very effective ways of putting things in a box that they can't tolerate in the present moment. And, you know, the fantasy we all have, understandably, is, well, then that just kind of goes away. Whatever was stuck in the box, eventually it'll just go away if I just live my life. But actually what happens is that we're energetically... an analogy would be that we're keeping a lid on the box. And that when we start meditating and we start letting go of having so much control, right? So when we come and just allow ourselves to experience our breath, we're sort of, from a psychological point of view, we're stopping tinkering with ourselves. We're stopping pushing down that lid. And what can happen is that stuff can start to come up. So I had a woman call me 2 weeks ago who's a former client of mine and a meditator and a Buddhist. And we haven't worked together in about a year or so. And she called me and said that she'd been doing a lot of intensive meditation. She did a 2-week mindfulness awareness retreat and was practicing every day. And that she was starting to feel very intense emotions, very intense fear and sadness and anger. And she was having flashes of memories come up. Her parents were very abusive towards her and her brother. And she coped very well by becoming very smart and achieving in school and getting out of her house and just being a very high achiever in her life. And from an ordinary point of view, we might say, well, what's going on here? You know, I'm doing this mindfulness awareness meditation, which is supposed to be calming and peaceful and maybe a little blissful, and I'm experiencing pain and sadness and rage. What's going on? Well, what's going on is what we come to understand and now in the mental health field is, well, trauma wants to be acknowledged in order to be healed. And so it comes to the surface so we can bear witness to it and take care of it. And there's a great line actually from the Shambhala teachings that we put that fearful mind in a cradle of loving kindness. So whatever comes up in our meditation practice that's painful, whether it's physical pain or psychological pain, that we can create an attitude of care and compassion for those feelings, rather than trying to push them away or ignore them or label them as inconvenient or me going crazy, whatever we habitually do. But in terms of the cells, I show in two, book number two, which is very cool. Some of you may know it. It's The Biology of Belief. This is written by a cell biologist, Dr. Lipton. The first half is really amazing. The second half, he kind of ventures into territory that's not quite his expertise, so it's a little less engaging. But it's a very, very good look at how you could think about your body, each cell, and then the body as a whole, and then community as an organism, because the patterning is actually the same, which is very interesting. Biology of Belief.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, of course. This gentleman here.
I think that one of the most important things that you said dealt with the issue of belief. To Westerners, certainly to Western intellectuals.
Can you bring it up?
Sure,
There we go. Thank you.
To Westerners, certainly to Western intellectuals, belief has become almost a dirty word.
That's great, yeah.
Mainly because of the way they feel about religion and because of the way, basically, well, I won't get to start talking about religion. And so I think you were correct in what you said, that people sort of want proof, you know, does this work? Is it scientific? For some reason or other, I'm very thankful that early on in my practice, I developed a sense of belief in the teachings of the Buddha that was unshakable. It just felt true, it felt right. And indeed, it is that belief that has enabled me to maintain this very nonlinear path over a course of, you know, decades, because it is everything, you know, you think you've made progress and then something happens and say, wait, what's going on here? And it's that belief, you know, that there's this Bach hymn, which translates in English that, you know, mighty fortress is our God. And really one's belief is a mighty fortress. And I think that belief is necessary to really sort of continue. But it's also necessary, as you said, for change. I was talking with a friend the other night after doing a spiritual reading, and the book that we're reading, the writer said that, who is a very spiritual person, said that he chants, you know, mantras when he goes to bed. And when he wakes up in the morning, he feels that his burdens have been lifted from him and that they are in the hands of his true Buddha nature. And my friend said, I chant mantras when I go to bed and I don't feel that way in the morning. And I said, well, let me ask you a question. When you chant mantras, do you have the intent to turn your will and your life over to the care of your true Buddha nature? No, he doesn't. And so these things, they can work at a certain level to a certain extent, but they can't really work deeply if you don't have that intent mm-hmm. behind them. You can't expect the result if you don't have the intention. So I think that what you said about belief is just very, very, very important. So thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you. This gentleman here and then this gentleman in the front.
I have a question, I guess, about pharmacology.
And about what?
About pills.
About pills?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And I mean, just a little background, I guess. I mean, I started practicing 2.5 years ago, and I saw a lot of significant progress and something that gave me something to latch onto, although it's been very up and down, but it's been sort of like this. And I guess my bigger question is meditation sufficient when you are talking about certain traumas that have happened in your life and trying to transcend them or heal from them? Or are there times where, I mean, you're obviously a psychotherapist. I don't know if you prescribe pills and things. And I've always been resistant because of seeing how it's ravaged certain lives in my life. Mm-hmm. Even though I self-medicated with other substances for many years.
Right, sure.
But I'm still like, well, when I still feel these blips and sometimes the practice doesn't feel helpful or I can't access it in the moment, that's where I go, do I need these other resources?
Right. Well, that's a very good question, and I think it's very important to be aware of, well, what am I trying to accomplish, right? To really be practical, right? Because, again, a meditation practice is about enlightenment, right? It's not about having less anxiety, you know, when you go out for dinner with friends, right? So it's good to know, and then to be very practical of like, well, what supports help me? I always tell people, think of it like a teepee, right? You know, because if it's an A-frame, you take away one support and you fall on your face, right? But if it's a teepee, well, then you're taking care of yourself, caring for this sentient being, right? In many different ways. And so what are those ways that actually help me to calm down and cheer up, as I say? So this is my graph that I use. It's a very sophisticated graph, my thumb and my index finger and then the space above and space below. So up here, this is the fight, flight, freeze response, right? This is anxiety, racing thoughts, insomnia, you know, hypervigilance, always feeling like we got to be on the go, right? That's up here. Down here is the freeze response. That's depression. That's hopelessness, helplessness, collapse. I don't want to do anything. Why bother? I have no power. Give up, right? This is the what we could call the emotional brain, the limbic brain, right? That's the, when the brain is misperceiving. So we now understand in the field of mental health that the biggest problem is that the brain gets habituated, the same as mind, right? So we get habituated to that fight-flight response or that freeze response. Or another way of saying is we get habituated to thinking we're always in danger. So we use one of three strategies, right? We go flight, we go into fight, anger, or we go into freeze, right? And so then what's that space in the middle? This space in the middle is the space where it's easiest to meditate. This is the regulated brain. This is the brain seeing, perceiving the environment internally, externally as safe. Nothing's going to harm me in the next minute. So then I can be in a state of calm. I can be open. I can focus if I need to focus. It's where we're playful, where we're spontaneous and creative. That's the zone, right? So another way of answering your question, right, is like, well, what's going to help me get more in this zone? Because this is like where I want to live. This is also where it's easy to meditate. Because if the central nervous system is thinking that you're constantly in danger and you're sitting quietly, that's kind of a stupid thing to do, right? Get up, do something, or fall asleep, right? Fight, flight, or freeze. So it's also more helpful to our meditation practice if we can be more in that regulated brain zone. So for you, it's really to think practically and not to be dogmatic, you know, about what actually supports me. Right? Diet, exercise, sleep, connection with friends, right? Time outdoors in nature, that's a huge regulator for people, right? Maybe meditation, you know? What are my beliefs, right? Self-examination of my own thinking, my own beliefs, you know? All those good things.
Thank you.
Sure, you're welcome.
You partly answered my question just now, so I can pass the mic to somebody else.
All right, this woman right here. Thank you.
I was wondering, when you're working with clients with anxiety or with depression, and you're maybe using meditation, do you adapt the traditional approaches of maybe a breath meditation in order to work with strong emotion or to work with ruminative thoughts?
Right, so how do you bring working with your thoughts and your emotions into meditation practice? Yeah. So mindfulness meditation, we can use anything as the object, right? So what we're taught here is we're taught mindfulness of breath as the object. But there's nothing particularly sacred about the breath. It's an easy object because it's always here, right? But it's also very helpful. And it's interesting to see that there are a number of teachers, Buddhist teachers, who are teaching on working with the emotions. Panla Prabhache just came out with a book. And also the Dalai Lama just sponsored a really amazing website. If anybody knows the name of it, we could post it. Atlas of Emotions, that's right, yeah. Paul Ekman, and it's this beautiful website where they demonstrate all the different nuances of the different emotions. So working with the emotions is a very important part of the path because, right, they're very inviting and scary and distracting and huge form of entertainment. Right? We are entertained by our suffering, for sure. So yes, you can definitely, you know, adapt mindfulness meditation kind of in the way that I talked about, you know, with Chris, and being able to take whatever that emotion is, to be able to experience it as an experience in the body, right? So then it can become a non-conceptual reference point. That's much easier, more truthful. And then that you could actually have an attitude of care, right? So that we actually have more resources than we give ourselves credit. That we could take that pain or that sadness or that confusion, and that we could surround it by warmth and affection. And just having, but then there's also an inherent belief in there, which is that your emotions are workable, right? You don't have to run away from them. You could actually meet them directly. And so that belief, although I don't state it explicitly, right, that's inherent in that instruction. And that's very liberating because we all have emotions all the time, and they're certainly non-linear, right, and quite spontaneous, and so it's very helpful to have an attitude that they're workable. Well, thank you, everybody, for coming back from your holiday and practicing and joining in our conversation.
No, thank you, Natalie Baker. Thank you for listening, all of you listeners out there. Visit us at ny.chambala.org for more information about classes and weekend retreats. The holiday she was referring to, by the way, was Memorial Day. This talk was recorded at the end of May. If you happen to live in New York City, you know, you can come and hear these talks live and meet teachers like Natalie Baker and the other great teachers you hear on this podcast in person. It's every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock, our weekly Dharma gathering. If you happen to live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. Look us up. Tell your friends about the podcast. Thanks for listening. Later.